Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, 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 what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do, and you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech. Yo, yo, check this out. This is your girl, Cola Vogue, and I'm chilling with my boys right here on Off the Cuff Radio. We off the cuff right now. You dig?
What's up? It's your boy Lil Yap from UNLV. Ragging them from the river. Cooling with my homies and my family at Off the Cuff Radio. Y'all be sure to tune in on Fridays and get the latest scoop and find out what's happening. You hear me?
And it's Queen Crazy, your girl's favorite bartender.
And we're from
Sex on the Rocks Podcast.
All right, you're now tuning in to Off the Cuff Radio.
Yeah, because they keep representing that world of hip hop. Well, much love.
All right.
Y'all, this is Miss Erica, and you're now tuned in to Off the giving a shout out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. And I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey y'all, this is Stacey Lachey giving a shout out to King Eric and Off the Cuff Radio.
What's shaking, y'all? This is the Grand, one half of Lost Cause and one third of that Drive Time thing. Sending my love to the homies over at Off the Cuff Radio. Tune in every Friday night for some real deal hip-hop conversation. These dudes are the connoisseurs of this thing. You already know what it is. BX Stand Up, Hud City, was shaking. Peace.
Yo, this is Joe Fresh the Dime, and y'all tuned in to the most raw, untouched show on radio, the Guillotine Team, Off the Cuff, and yo, Eric Sandman, off of these clowns.
And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. Look, the only reason I survive, cause a nigga is special first. You get successful, then it gets stressful, thirst. Niggas gon' test you, see what your texture's worth. Diamonds and pipes, one of them pressure burst. Street niggas, still I get checks and spurts. I'm for peace, but before I get pressed, I murk. Better days pray for, but expecting worse. At this level, bullshit, I'm just less concerned. Cruising in the six, looking at the proceeds of rap music on my wrist. Drop another mixtape, my shit booming out this bitch. Young Malcolm, I'm the leader of the movement out this bitch, look. And this is what it feels like. Reach a level, make you question, is it real life? All the weed good, all the pussy real tight. In the only room, keep your dollar bills right. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like.
Scorpion bricks, way before Orbeez double disc, 40 on my lap, clap, sound like 40 did the mix, filtered bass, sip coat, like a Michelin star chef, chef, kiss to my wrist, I go dummy with my left, I arrest on my dick, try to audit all my checks, too late, you know they hate when you become more than they expect, you let them crack a storm your capital, put their feet up on your desk, and yet you talking tough to me, I lost all my little respect, I'm selling weed, in the open, bringing folks home from the feds, I know the payback gon' be mean, I'm saving all my little bread, pray for me y'all, one day I'ma have to pay for these thoughts, real niggas. Is extinct. It ain't safe for me, my dog. They killing niggas in they own hood. That makes sense to you at all. You burnt your bridge to the other side. You know you can't swim across. Y'all know niggas can't swim. They fried Mike after he died. Y'all know niggas can't win. You never land on your side. I arrived on the day Fred Hampton got assassinated, just to clarify further. What y'all gave birth is the chairman mixed with Jeff Ford. Big step on the jet with my legs crossed. Black stones on my neck, y'all can't kill Christ. Black Messiah is what I feel like. Shit ain't gon' stop till y'all spill blood. We gon' turn up even more since y'all killed cubs.
And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like.
As he put this shit in.
And this is what it feels like.
Feels so fucking good.
And this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like. What it feels like.
Live and direct in the building, King Eric, the Media Assassin, Off the Cuff Radio, y'all. That track we just played there is from the late Nipsey Hussle and Jay-Z, titled What It Feels Like. We had to let y'all know that we provide the good music as well as the dope interviews. So let me bring on my host, T-Max, with the facts in the building.
What it do, what it do. Friday Night Lights, OTCF in the building. We are sponsored by Da Vinci Clothing, Jesse's Boutique, Buddy Boy Entertainment, and Dirty Basement Radio. I am T-Max with the Facts, along with the head host with the most, King Eric the Ruler. Shout out to our co-host in spirit, Ilada Sandman, and Lady Chinchilla Soilla. And I have to preface this show to say, in our long and illustrious history, we have had a series of firsts, haven't we, King?
Oh, yeah.
And
we surely did.
And our, yeah, and we have had the pleasure of having, you know, hip-hop artists. We have had, you know, photographers, producers. And this is the first time we have ever had an artist on our show in terms of actually a painter. For all of you that know, everything that is related to hip-hop culture from what we've done on this show, whether it be actors, actresses, music, whatever, art is just as much a part of it as anything. And tonight's guest, to call him talented is seriously, you know, it is an understatement, because this man right here is beyond talented. His gift is anointed in the cosmic sense of creativity with an incredible imagination. This man right here puts on the West so much, making the whole coast his canvas to articulate himself in such a tremendous fashion. And we're here to get his story. And I'm going to tell y'all now, this is going to be a lot, so tune in. Without further ado, we welcome the most magnificent on the canvas, Sinister Monopoly, real name Jason Barbour. What's going on, man?
Hey, man, what's cracking? Man, what an introduction. I mean, that was articulate in itself. I really appreciate that. You know, anytime I can hear some positive words like that, it just kind of like brings it full circle of like why I do what I do, right? And makes it, you know, I love when people come out and really get into it and say, oh, I dig it, you know?
Man, look, we are so happy to have you on the show. This goes back a month and a half ago, of course, when we first linked up, when I, you know, was on IG, you know, because that's part of what we do on this show in terms of, you know, whether we reach out to guests ourselves or many of our friends, you know, reach out to us with people, you know, or whether King may find somebody or I do. And stumbling across your page, Jason, I was just blown away. I mean, the level of creativity, the just overall vision, the scope of it. I told King, I was like, King, we got to have this guy on here.
Yeah, right? Oh, man. Right on. So let me ask you guys, like, a quick question. You know, through hip-hop, there's, of course, you know, if we even just go back to, you know, when it originally kind of started and when people were doing, like, you know, graffiti in the streets and it kind of was in all the background of the music videos and in some cases, you know, album covers, like some of the like an album cover I think of sometimes is Ice-T, and I think even KRS-One did a pretty cool one where it was all, you know, like done by an artist as opposed to like a computer or a photograph, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah. And when you're dealing with art, Jason, you're dealing with something from a perspective of, you know, graffiti has always been an element of hip-hop culture. You know, some people are quick to dismiss it as nothing more with vandals and with spray cans, but that's just a craft and, to me, disrespectful dismissal because hip-hop is birthed from the streets, you know. And for that art to be expressed, I mean, shout-out to some of the artists like Scene, you know, Dez, you know, and Banksy. Will expand on him more tonight because he correlates to what you do as well in terms of the fame you both have achieved. You know, it is something that is, you know, when you really understand the nuance in terms of the lines, the grit, the expression, the spontaneity of its, you know, creativeness, you know, it's just as much anything. You know, and you know, we've seen it come all over the world, you know, and, you know, I guess this is where, you know, we wanted to bring you in because what you do, because Nia King did some homework on you, man, and I mean, we had an idea when we did the homework on you, we were like, I don't think we were ready for what we saw.
Oh, is that right? Oh, okay, all right.
Dude, right, you are major out here.
Sure.
You know, you are major. You know, I mean, I guess we just get right into it. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you're from California. You know, tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, and, you know, your path, you know, from the past to the present to now.
Sure, sure. I'll try to leave my answer is short-winded, so that way, you know, you guys, we could fit in a lot of questions. So I wasn't born and raised, but, you know, before the age of one, I was already, you know, living in Manhattan Beach, California, and this is, you know, early 70s, and it's Los Angeles County, but we refer to this area as the South Bay. And for those who might know, it's just a small beach community, and there's a lot of little towns that intertwine, you know, border each other, like you know, so I'm in Manhattan Beach, and then there's Hermosa Beach, Redondo Beach, and then right near me is El Segundo, and then LAX Airport, where, you know, most people fly in when you fly into LA, like to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right there in the beach community, you know, 10-15 minutes away. So I've kind of been here my whole life other than when, you know, I started at one point and, you know, before I went away and like balling out of control, I was, you know, traveling and moving and, you know, living in other areas. But I've always been rooted here in like Manhattan Beach, the South Bay. Yeah.
And when you say El Segundo, of course we think of Tribe Called Quest, you know, off of
the
debut album in 1990.
Right.
So, you know, off of their debut album.
I love Tribe Called Quest.
You know, it's, yeah, Think the Past and the Travels of Rhythm, of course, when they had their, I believe that was their first video, I Left My Wallet in El Segundo. And you said the Beach District. That would be Huntington Beach being, would Huntington Beach be involved there too?
You know, That's a little more, I guess, it was south of where I'm at, and it's probably, it's not far, though, maybe maybe like 35, 40 minutes from you know, Manhattan, Hermosa. But yeah, it's all kind of similar when you look at the, you know, the community itself. They all resemble each other, you know. So I kind of grew up in,
Right, and I asked that, Jason, because, of course, rest in peace to one of the all-time great heavy metal guitarists, Jeff Hanneman of Slayer, because I'm a huge Slayer fan.
There you go.
Of course,
I can appreciate that.
So, yeah, and he's from Huntington Beach, California. So, yeah, you know, I believe he was born, I want to say he was actually, want to make sure I don't get it wrong, I want to say he may have been born in Oakland and then moved to Huntington Beach, or he may have been born and raised in Huntington Beach, but he's definitely, you know, one of the, you know, godfathers of thrash metal and guitarists, one of the greatest ever, and I'm a definite fan. But yeah, man, go ahead, please, continue.
Okay, Where's the next jump off? What are we getting into right here? Other than like where I'm from or a little bit of background in my area.
We going through your inspirations, man. Like, what made you want to tap into that lane of showcasing artistry?
Okay. Yeah. So, like even when I was kind of young, maybe before I can even had a driver's license, I was already kind of like a DJ, right? I had the turntables, the mixer, and I would even write rap lyrics, and like I had this whole rap persona. So I myself came from like pretty deep rooted, you know, hip hop. So then I started doing, you know, just like, you know, in school, like doing little graffiti, and then a little bit on the streets, but nothing like I wouldn't say that I'm a graffiti artist by any means, right? And so then I started kind of painting a little bit, you know, in high school, just for fun, you know, for hobby. My mom kind of started it, and so I started painting a little bit, and then, you know, every time I would finish something, you know, even being like, you know, 15, 16 year old, my mom's friends would come by, or my friends, people always wanted it, like as soon as it was done, but I never equated in my head that it was something that I could do as a career and make money. It never like registered like that, right? And so, you know, then life kind of goes on, and I just kind of left that as a recreation hobby, and then just got into life, and I kind of did some things, like I had a car audio, car window tinting, auto shop in Redondo Beach. And since I had that, I would get a lot of, you know, like, you know, dope dealers and stuff of that era, you know, coming through. And that was like, so I kind of got turned on to, you know, I started selling like cannabis, you know, amongst my friends that I grew up with, right? And so then it just got to where like, I thought I would at some point maybe just do the cannabis industry only, because it seemed like it was working out pretty well for me. So mm-hmm. I eventually ended up getting rid of, you know, my auto shop, and kind of just doing that full time, and ended up going like, you know, to a very large scale with what I was doing. So much so that, you know, after putting many years of work and building up reputations and whatnot, I ended up fast forward really fast, is I got busted by the feds, and I was using my own private airplanes. When I say private airplanes, I wasn't the pilot, but I purchased planes, and I had a pilot, and orchestrated the pilot to, you know, agree to fly, you know, cannabis all over the U.S. for me. So once he said he was down, and I had all of the, you know, the work to throw on the plane, then, you know, it was kind of a no-brainer, and it just kind of spread amongst, when I was like hitting up people in LA, hey, do you know somebody in Detroit? Do you know anybody in Atlanta? And it just started kind of, you know, slowly spreading. And, you know, after a few years, as the feds caught up to me, eventually I had three airplanes and three pilots in constant motion, you know, throughout the U.S., you know, moving, you know, large amounts of weed. So then I ended up getting, you know, caught, and I got sentenced to a little over 11 years. And so during my time while I was incarcerated, there was a prison in California that I was incarcerated in called Terminal Island. And Terminal Island had a hobby shop. And in the hobby shop, you can submit forms, and they'll eventually, if there's not a waiting list, you can get like a locker. And with that locker, you can order art supplies, like from a catalog, and they'll take your money out of the commissary. So I started ordering, you know, canvas, paint, brushes, and literally it just kind of, you know, started from the beginner. And, you know, as anybody does when they're starting with something, as a beginner, you know, it has very challenging and it wasn't so good. And in retrospect, when I look at a painting now and I see that it's signed, you know, 2015, I can definitely see like the growth, you know, as a beginner level to like maybe where I'm at now as a painter. So basically just kind of almost doing being, you know, an outlier and putting in the work. I probably painted 6 years straight for 7 days a week. And so, you know, that just kind of like the whole time knowing towards the end that when I get out, this was something I'm going to at least, you know, kind of give it maybe a 2 years and see how it goes for me. And so before I had left the prison, I was mailing paintings home to my family, and I had probably about 120 paintings put away.
Oh, wow.
And I was going to use that as my springboard. And it wasn't, I didn't have social media before I went away. So I was able to have my phone while I was in a halfway house. So as soon as I got out, I was in a halfway house that we have out here in Watts. And I was sitting in there, and an art gallery sent me a DM and was asking me. And, you know, I kind of thought, whatever. And I quoted him some prices, and, you know, I didn't know anything about really quoting prices. And so we ended up just, you know, kind of leaving our DM, you know, like it didn't work out, you know? And so, while I was sitting there a few days later, I decided to just call the gallery and speak to the guy and kind of just, you know, figure out a little bit more about the piece he was asking about. So then as we started talking and I told him about my story, and I was literally, you know, probably a month out, maybe even less. And he told me to bring some artwork into his gallery. So I did. And then instantly, you know, he was like, it happened to be kind of around like the Black Friday where everyone shops. And so he was like, hey, let's, you know, do like a little where if you could come into the gallery and paint live and people come in and watch you. And so I even had to get like permission from, you know, my case manager at the halfway house to do that. So I did. And even on the way there, he's like, hey, you know, there's people here waiting. When will you be here? And it didn't even equate in my head, like there's people waiting, you know, like whatever. And so when I walked in, people had already bought artwork. People wanted to take pictures and, you know, sign the back of their artwork. And so since then, it's kind of just, you know, my hustler mentality. I kind of saw that maybe, you know, people digged it, and I just, you know, went for it, and, you know, here we are today. I've probably been out of the feds like 2 years now, and since those 2 years, I've probably sold like probably a little over 100 original paintings, which I don't know how many, you know, most artists do, if that's good or what, but I figure that's pretty good for just kind of only being on the art scene, 2 years, you know?
Now, you know, in getting your product out there, man, like how vital is networking with people and getting your product out there? Because, you know, painting, you know, a lot of painters are pretty much introverts. And they don't really know how to really, you know, correlate with people. Like, what was your strategy in getting your paintings out there?
Well, it kind of started with that particular gallery. And then from then, you know, just kind of like, maybe going to like social settings, you know, in LA and, you know, kind of maybe, you know, hearing about a show or knowing an artist and kind of, for now or when I first got out, it was kind of more, just my community and people hearing about it as opposed to, you know, like me, you know, going out of the way to, you know, contact an art gallery far away like Miami or New York. And, but since then, you know, every now and then, I get, you know, contact from, you know, these other areas, but I myself don't like go out and solicitate, you know, just yet, because you know, I'm, I guess, busy enough, you know, and maybe at some point, ideally I would like to have somebody that could even, you know, do that stuff out there for me, and I can just concentrate on being a painter, you know. But it is tough to be like every like person. It's almost like a full business, and you know, and I'm like just this, you know, the painter, so I have to be the salesperson, I have to get the product out, contact these people. So there's a lot to it, you know. So
yeah, you know, and one thing about it, you know, Jason, is when you look at when we're listening to all this, and we're one thing is, you know, we're just your humility is just so refreshing, because you know, I mean, we understand the significance in terms of what you're saying. I mean, especially from where you started, you know when you were in your previous occupation, and I mean, just to give context to this, because this is the 80s. We're coming off of the 70s with George Young, you know Barry Seal, who was a pilot, you know, Griselda Blanco. For those who know the stories, they know the stories. We know the stories. And you are right up there with them in terms of how big you were, I mean, at the time. You know, so this is like, you know, so you were a major player. So you've seen this from all sides in terms of, you know, where what it took in terms of your networking, transport, and then profit to where, you know, you had to, you know, sit down for a little while, got out. And now, you know, when you legitimizing your hustle, you know, you have, it's the same thing, but on a bigger scale. You know,
no, it absolutely is. Not to interrupt you, but there's, I think, even like the real, not the rapper Rick Ross, but the inmate Rick Ross. I think he has a book, and it talks about something, how people that, you know, are dope dealers or ex-dope dealers, they just have to change the way they think, and really, like, almost any product can be that. So now for me, you know, like back in the day I sold cannabis, now I sell artwork, and it's kind of like, you know, I could equate it to like a painting is a few pounds or whatever, right? You know, it's just trading products, right? And so, yeah, once you kind of learn that, and you are energetic or a hustler, then, you know, now with social media, how you can reach everybody.
Definitely. And to go further deeper in detail with that, Jason, because the logistics of it are, like King so astutely, you know, stated, a lot of artists are introverts. And one thing about it is art is such a personal expression, yet has a profound impact. With you, you know, finding, because we were looking on your gallery online, and we've seen how much some of those paintings go for, and rightfully so, because, I mean, these are just, I mean, my God, I'm like, and to even get to those prices that they are, I'm like, somebody really likes it, because, of course, in the art world, you have your appraiser who looks at it in terms of the language, the boldness, the innovation, the design, everything, and that's pretty much how the market is dictated. And from there, you know, you came in a spot where, we have to make sure we do the craft justice. We have to make sure, you know, we respect your name in all of this, because when you look at individuals like Jack Nicholson, who has an extensive and famous art collection, Jay-Z as well, you know, art is a very big currency out there in terms of what these paintings appreciate. To give, and you seem to have been, your work resonated enough with buyers, with the public, you know, which would translate into buyers, because, you know, you have the, you know, you didn't have to go out like Vincent Van Gogh, you know, who, you know, cut off his ear because he felt like nobody paid attention, and Van Gogh's paintings were not worth anything until after he died. Obviously, that's not the case for you because you're doing pretty damn well with it. But when we look at some of the artists, you know, Pablo Picasso, Leonardo da Vinci, you know, they all found a lane in terms of Da Vinci with his, you know, Da Vinci was just an unbelievable genius because he was a mathematician, scientist, and painter. Very rarely do you have people that hit that trifecta of genius, and he hit all three. You know, of course, Pablo Picasso with his, you know, neo-cubist abstract designs in terms of what made it different for these times. And, of course, you got to remember these paintings go back 300, 400, 500 years, give or take. You know, and you, for where hip-hop culture, where fashion is, especially pop culture, because we got to dive into some of these inspirations. Dude, I was through in a good way when I saw the Richie Rich with the sniper with the shotgun with the Gucci earmuffs. I was like, "Yo, this dude is serious." Oh man, I mean,
yeah,
you know,
the Monopoly one. He made the Monopoly man look like a G on a lot of these joints.
Uncle Moneybags. Shout out to Uncle Moneybags of Monopoly, man.
Go ahead. My interpretation of, you know, the way I paint him is, you know, he's when you play Monopoly and it says go straight to jail, you know, that's the character that I, you know, that I paint, right? He's, you know, like we all have our good and our bad side. I paint the bad side and, like, you know, like what extent someone might go to get, you know, money, you know, even from maybe illegal or sarcasm or funny, you know. So, yeah, I always call them gangster monopolies.
Hence the name Sinister Monopoly, because it was such a flip on the actions. Because one thing about it is art is meant to provoke thought in terms of the, you know, what the message is. I mean, when you look at Rodin's Thinker, one of the most iconic pieces of all time. You know, when you look,
I did that like, too. I remixed it.
Yeah, Jason, that's exactly what it is. You remixed it. You know, because what you did was you put your own modern spin on iconic, but you add on to it where the legacy of it, where you kept the where you kept the message intact, but you've given it a more updated meaning. I mean, when you look at guys like Rembrandt, who was, you know, just so elegant in his, you know, in his approach to it. I mean,
it's kind of like a painter. It's almost like a musician, like a Bruno Mars that takes a beat that kind of sounds more like a 90s beat than a 2021, right? And it gives it that, you know, that more raw, eclectic, I guess, if you want to say on it, right? So it's the same thing, you know, like he's taking an old beat and then turning it into something, or I guess if that makes any sense. And it's kind of like me just taking an old beat and turning it into something new too, right? You know?
Well, it's a perfect analogy, Jason, because what you have is that just like hip-hop music and, you know, shout out to our guests, past and present, we've talked about, because when you talked about, you know, how long you were really doing it for, like, 6-7 years straight, you were, like, painting, you know, shout out to one of our past guests, Young Sleep, and he talked about with his rhyming, you know, about how it takes 10,000 hours and anything to really perfect your craft. Mm-hmm. So one thing about it is that you first have to have the dedication and you have to enjoy what you do. When you think about another famous artist, Andy Warhol, who said everyone's going to have their 15 minutes of fame. For those of our listeners that don't know, Andy Warhol is the creator of the Campbell Soup label, I believe, in terms of, you know, he was the one that, you know, made that, who created that, if not the painting, he actually was the one that did
it. He was the originator, the original.
The original, yes, the original creator of the Campbell's Soup label that they use to this day. You know, I mean, when you have guys like Borglum, Ducamp, you know, Manet, Vermeer, you know, these are, you know, these are the, it's no
abstract
different than what you have. Not so much, yeah, abstract, and then just the classic lines. These are about what art is defined as. You know, as we go into, you know, the hip-hop correlation, the analogy, as you stated, Jason, about, you know, this is like when you're taking a James Brown sample or you're flipping an Isley Brothers sample or...
Exactly what I'm saying,
you know,
yeah.
Or you're flipping, you know, like, you know, what Jay-Z did on Blueprint 2 where he flipped Ennio Morricone's The Ecstasy of Gold off The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and flipped that into a track, you know. It's giving recognition and credit to the originals, and by the same time, because what is so beautiful about your artwork, what is so pertinent to its existence, what makes it so important is that people can enjoy it, and it's something that people really, it bridges gaps. It's something that is so cutting edge. It can be in high art, but it's hip enough that the average layman can enjoy it for what it is and not feel, you know, burdened with everybody trying to say, well, what do you get from it? Because like you said, man, when you look at what your characters bring to it, of course, Richie Rich and, you know, Uncle, you know, Moneybag, you know, from Monopoly, it's like they represent what it is in terms of the hustle and the struggle and getting it by any means. You know, look, anytime you can see a Monopoly character walking around with two Desert Eagles or a Heckler and Koch, that's pretty damn awesome.
That's a little, not to mention, it correlates real well. Like, the art correlates real well. It don't look janky. Because you can see, you can tell when you, sometimes you go to these swap meets, sometimes you go to these shows, you can tell somebody just put that stuff together. But you can tell that the way the background is and the way, it also tells a story. Like, even the one that you did with the vaccine shots and the one you did with Donald Trump, it tells stories as well.
Yeah.
Right,
yes,
right.
Yes,
got you.
Yes.
Go ahead. I think when you were saying, when you look at other ones, because Monopoly art is pop culture, and quite a few artists, they paint, you know, Scrooge or Monopoly, Richie Rich. So a lot of artists do it. And so you do sometimes run across, you know, where it just doesn't look right. And so that just is putting in the hours, right? Like the 10,000 hours, like that you talked about before just now. It's a prime example. So when I was incarcerated and I had a Hobby Locker, people oftentimes would get a new locker next to me and they never painted before. And they would get a, you know, like the raw prime canvas and try to have at it. And, you know, they would see that it's not easy. You know, oftentimes I think they would maybe like try to paint it like, let's say, one time. And in the end, like a painting, sometimes you're going to need at least three plus, you know, coats in order for it to look right. Because you just paint it one time, you can still see the undertone of the primer when you buy the canvas from the store. Right. And so, they would maybe get, you know, the whole thing covered and eliminate the white of the canvas and be like, yeah, it's done. And I would try to tell them, like, no, like, bro, you got to do this like two or three more times. And then so oftentimes they just couldn't, like, persevere through, like, the challenges or the struggles of being a beginner, you know, because it's not going to look right. And that's just, you know, when I said too at one point earlier today that when I look back at one of my earlier paintings, they weren't right either, you know, but I didn't have like Google as an inmate. So I kind of, that's one reason why it maybe didn't look right. You know, now I can, you know, Google images and have better art references and stuff. Right. But,
definitely.
Anyways, I'll let you guys go. I'm long winded over here.
No, you're good. We got plenty of time, Jason. You are perfectly fine. Editor's note, The Monopoly character's name is Wrench Uncle Pennybags. Like I said on the show, we always try to strive to be the most accurate from the most major to the most minor in reference to the information that is disseminated on this broadcast. You know, that's just what we do because, but yeah, man, I mean, but
hey,
you know,
hey,
one thing about
shoot,
it,
I gotta ask him this here, man. Now,
yeah, go ahead.
You being an artist, man, like, what are your top five hip hop covers?
Yes. We need this.
Huh. Like, I don't know, because it's like I haven't even really been in the clubs really that much because of, like, COVID and being out. But I've kind of always just, like, West Coast music, you know, like Game, Ice Cube, Dre. Those are kind of always been, you know, my thing kind of growing up. At one point, as when I was doing DJ stuff, I met somebody when I was buying records who, you know, he was actually friends with like NWA, and he would kind of invite me over, and at times, you know, all of those guys would be in the room. I didn't like have their phone number like we were friends, but I was, you know, invited all the time. And at one point I even was at like, I think Eazy-E's album cover when I'm like sitting in Eazy-E's car, like when they had a phone that was bolted down to the ground. And I'm probably like 16, and I hang out with those guys, right? Because I was just so into DJing, and this guy's name is actually that, you know, kind of brought me around. I met him in Gardena when we were buying records, and his name was DJ Speed. And I think he's still doing his thing.
Whoa.
But I think he's even produced some beats for, like, the DOC, you know. But that's kind of always been my thing is, like, West Coast music, you know. To say, like, full-on club, I don't know. But I guess more, like, recently when I paint, you know, I kind of like listening to sometimes even, you know, my people might not judge me, right, the Weeknd, right? I think it's got, like, a good vibe for when I'm, you know, actually painting right now. You know?
Okay, two things. Number one, Jason, do you realize how small the world is? Shout out to DJ Speed because we interviewed him last year. Shout out to Sean.
Oh, yeah, like Sean, you know. Yeah. We kind of grew up. He used to, like, come to my house, and I would call him. Yeah, like, that was my buddy. Yep.
Yeah, we interviewed Steve last year. Shout out to Steve. And
right on.
I mean, dude, you just talk so nonchalantly, and I mean, me and King are just like, this dude was, like, around legends. Like, this dude was major. doing what he was doing, and this dude was around legends. I'm like, son.
Yeah, like 16 years old over there, like hanging out like with, you know, those guys or whatever, right? And then recently, I don't know if you guys saw on my Instagram, I did a painting for Ice Cube, and he loved it, you know? And back then, you know, I didn't know him so much to where he was in the room. He was just a little more quiet and a little more reserved. You know, but when I met him after we did this painting project, man, he was super cool dude, man. Yeah.
Dude.
So,
I mean, because we got to get into that too, because there's another thing called commissions as well. But before that, we got to give a shout out to The Weeknd, one of Canada's most talented. And nah, as far as we go, The Weeknd is all right with us. You know, I mean, he is talented, especially for his performance at this past Super Bowl. His performance was unbelievable. I mean, the dude is like, he's really one of the, you know, I think a lot of his for the type of alternative R&B he's done, you know, coming out over the years, you know, it was different. But now that it's really marinated in a sense, like, people really understand his genius, just like, you know, your genius has really gotten out there. Because to get a legend like Q, you said you did a painting for him. Now, was this something that was commissioned by him in terms of he gave you something specific that he wanted, or was it something that you already had in the stash that you had sold him?
No, this was Cube just recently, I don't know if you guys have noticed, he just launched his own cannabis brand,
okay.
Right? So I don't know if you guys know, but he has his own flower and his own pre-rolls. It's Friday Kush, and it's a good day, Kush. And so when they went to, you know, they're going to do a, I think, a, you know, a long-term photo session to, you know, promote all of the cannabis stuff. So at that point, I was kind of asked to, you know, do something that would kind of relate to the packaging, but my own spin on it on canvas. And I was originally more contacted by the cannabis brand working with Cube, right? But then once I, you know, presented the painting, then it kind of, you know, kind of changed, you know, so it was more like, I don't know, but originally it was a cannabis brand wanting to do it with their launch of, you know, the company itself and putting all his new, you know, his new company out with, it's called Caviar Gold. I don't know. The Caviar Gold is, it's huge here in California, and they are, you know, also licensed and branded in like many other states. So it's pretty cool to see somebody like, you know, those guys now from the legal aspect, and look, somebody even like Ice Cube, you know, have his own cannabis company. And then when I was there, people like Trib, you know, like, hey, you know, that this guy served over 10 years for cannabis, and here comes all the moguls now, and that's just on, you know, it's on for them, right? So but I don't ever have any hard feelings about, like, myself being incarcerated, you know. That was my thing, you know, and I don't really look back. But people do trip, you know. They're like, oh, man, you served all that time, and now it's legal, you know.
Well, you know, one thing about it is that King and myself, you know, we always talk about, you know, because one thing about hip-hop culture – in terms of what it's done for so many people. Shout out to Busta Rhymes. You know, years ago he said without hip-hop, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have jobs. You know, I think he said this to the Grammys some years ago. But one thing about it is that when you have moguls like Cube coming into the game, you know, recognizing, because one thing is, no matter what color we all come from, you know, especially if from the street, a shared struggle of survival and trying to, you know, make a way out of a situation that, you know, certain elements have been lodged against us as obstacles that we try to hurdle. Thus, when we are able to triumph from said obstacles, it is an achievement that deserves all type of accolades from all audiences for what we have overcome. I mean, dude, you are in the circles of, I mean, dude, when I went to your website and I saw one of those pictures going for $1 million, I was like, yo, if he can do that, that means obviously this guy has got some major, major, major clients. In terms
well,
of where
you want me
he
to,
can.
You want me to explain why that one is a million?
Please.
And you know, and it's actually to $1 million to whoever will pay $1 million, right? But so that is like the very first Monopoly that I ever did. And I did it while I was incarcerated. So the art gallery, when I pulled it out of my little, you know, like my little file archives, and I was like, hey, this is the very first one I ever did. And as my pieces started to sell that, you know, were so that I painted at Terminal Island while I'm incarcerated, you know, potentially fast forward 10 years from now and, you know, certain collectors might say, oh, yeah, I have one, but, you know, you don't have one that was painted while he was in, you know, in prison, right? So say I have the very first one he did. So that's kind of like why that one's listed like that. So I'll keep my fingers crossed, but I also think there's a new market with, like, the NFT stuff that's, you know, starting to happen and, you know, so maybe I could breach that $1 million mark, but for now we're just kind of have that there because it's the very first one.
Well,
and once it's gone, and then you know, like
exactly.
Once all the other ones from Terminal Island are gone, then people look back and say, well, there are none available on the market. You know.
Now my question to you is, now, do you get any type of pushback for the imagery used on the Rich Uncle kitty bags?
No, as of right now, no. You know, it's like there's different things if you, you know, use your own interpretation, and then there's forms of, like, being satire. I don't totally know the laws, but right now, you know, I just, you know, like Pablo Picasso said, some good artist copy, great artist steal. So for now, I'll just keep jacking.
But from that perspective, though, Parker Brothers has not issued any type of cease and desist order or trademark infringement claim against you?
No, nope.
Okay, so we're gonna knock on wood and pray and spread sage all over the place, hoping they don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to make board games. I'm just over here, you know, making some art. And so, but either way, you know, like if that time comes, you know, my skill level as an artist, I can just pivot and I'll just keep it pushing. You know, but for now, I'll just have fun with it. That's one of the reasons why I paint that character is because it's fun, you know. Like a perfect example is while I was incarcerated, inmates would come and say, hey, you know, can you paint a picture of my wife and my kids? And, you know, absolutely I could, you know, and I could do my best to make it look just like the photograph. But when I would agree to do those, and there were times where I did, I would, like, be sitting in my cell and know that they're going to open the yard and I'm going to go to the hobby shop pretty soon and never wouldn't look forward to it. Like, oh, that's just no fun to paint some people I don't even know, you know. But when I do things like the Monopoly guy and I'm making him have fun and do shit, then I could sit in my cell and be like, man, when are they going to open the door so I can go paint, you know? And then I would sit there and think, like, I can't wait for the day where they let me out, where I can just paint, like, all through the night, because I couldn't paint in my cell. I could only paint right in a designated hobby area. And those are only open through, you know, maybe I could paint like 4 or 5 hours a day. So, like, in the morning, I would always work out, right? And then so after lunch, I would come and I could put in 2-3 hours. And then, you know, in the evening, another couple hours. But it's also obstructed time because I painted publicly at the prison. And, you know, inmates come by and we hang out. We sometimes even like, oh, let's get a bag of chips and, you know, we just start chopping it up, and then I'm not painting at that point, you know?
Well, so one thing we can say about it, with you, you know, with your tremendous talent behind those walls, we know nobody didn't fuck with you, because they had to deal with some shot callers behind there if something happened to you. So you were protected. We know that.
Right, right.
You know, we know how that works out there, you know, and you have the respect of all the, you know, the bosses on the yard, you know, the shot callers. So, you know, you didn't have to worry about nothing.
Now they call him Moneybag. They're like, nah, we ain't messing with Moneybags.
You know, at one point I stopped painting for inmates just so I can have, you know, like a jump off point for when I got out and have a bunch of paintings, you know, kind of like, you know, almost like a savings account ready to go as an artist for my resume, rather than, you know, hitting the streets and, you know, having 10 paintings. Wait, now I lost my train of thought where I was going with this. What were we talking about on the question?
No, it's okay. About Sorry. In terms of, you know, because you were talking about, you know, we're talking about your talent was notable, that you had something that, you know, obviously, you know, nobody was going to bother you or they were going to face consequences inside, but you were talking about, you know.
How, oh,
no, you know,
now
you,
I remember. So
yeah.
What I was saying is
yeah.
Eventually inmates would come by and they would want to buy a Monopoly. They would be like, oh, that's dope, you know, like, can you sell that? And I would tell them, no, it's not for sale. And they would like, look at me like, and then sometimes they would try to, you know, in prison, the currency of my painting wouldn't be valued at very much, right? So, but in prison, it would be worth a lot. Like, obviously, there's a total dollar exchange rate between prison and the free world. So in prison, you know, like, even if they would offer me a lot and I would be like, nah, after a while, they would just think, like, if they don't know me, like, they're not in my circle and they just kind of know of me, they start thinking I'm a dick and I'm an asshole, like, there's that dude that he's almost like the Seinfeld episode, the soup Nazi. You get nothing.
You get no soup for you.
Yeah, right. So yeah, so but that's all, right?
But yeah, but one thing about it, because I mean, we're getting so much content. I mean, we're loving this interview. One thing that people have to understand about art, because what you were saying about how you were on average be out about 5-6 hours a day, is that when you're dealing with creativity, creativity can hit any time. You know, so, you know, especially with you being, you know, back in the world again, you know, with, you know, you get an idea late at night, you can just get up, you know, and get everything and just go to work with it. Where, like you said, when you were locked down, you know, you didn't have that freedom of movement. And that's important because it keeps your artistic, you know, juices flowing in terms of what you are able to create. We got to go back in terms of what you talk about in terms of, like you said, the million dollar, because this correlates once again in terms of One of a Kind, the beginning. It's like the RZA's album, the one, the special, only one copy ever produced in the special metal box with all types of bells and whistles that was gone into doing it. You know, the Once Upon a Time in Shaolin Wu-Tang album, you know, that was purchased, you know, by Martin Shkreli, which we're so happy was, I think it was relieved from him when he got locked up for that bullshit he was doing, but that's another story. You know, but that album, King, how much did RZA say that album was going for initially when he said it was, he was selling it for how much when that album, when he said it?
It was $2 million.
Yeah. And then put stipulations on it, like, no, the world couldn't hear it for 88 years, you know. But then he also had another crazy stipulation, like if somebody could break into someone's house with Bill Murray and they stole it, then it was fair game. I mean, but that's RZA. We love RZA. RZA would get out there on stuff. But, yeah, but, I mean, but, Jason, I mean, these are, this is like your, those pictures, because obviously, look, you did a picture for Ice Cube. That's enough as is. So obviously you got some pull. So when people can look, and like you said, from where you looked at where you started at first to where you are at now, this is something that is personal because you actually, this was your baby. You know, this is a testament of where you come, and there's only one of them. So one thing, when you do have the market value for what it is, which you do, you obviously are doing pretty well with it. You do have a right to set your price for what you think for what you think is worth, and it's not some ego, arrogant, overinflated estimation. Dude, you have credentials that justify your going rate. You set the profit in turn. You set the market for what you're going to profit off of. And that's called supply and demand. That is called capitalism. That is called getting what your work deserves. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. King and myself.
Part of like, there's a lot to encompass that particular price, right? It can even go really just like story-wise, right? So oftentimes people, you know, might even just like my art after they hear the story, and they might have like looked at the art before the story, before they're hearing like, oh, it's cool, and then they hear the story, they're like, oh, no way, that's really cool, right? So when it's at that price, like, let's say I'm always kind of pushing in a way, and I have things, you know, that could potentially happen in the future, like, let's say I do end up getting like a Netflix documentary or something, right? So now that painting, you know, so it'll be like, you know, a huge commodity because like a more grand scale of the world has heard about the story. So I'm just kind of like waiting for this, my story to organically, if not, then I'll eventually, you know, try to seek it out more for it to get like broadcast on a more major scale, right? And so,
and
hold on
one
second, y'all. Now we gotta one second. I'm just wondering where kind of where I'm taking callers here. So we have a 310 caller here. We got Sinister Monopoly on the line. We're taking questions.
LA, what it do?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how you
doing?
I have
a question. I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing?
We're great. We're great. Thank you for calling. What's your question?
Yeah. My question was, what made you go to like that whole style of like really dark and like what do you, is that something like you put your feelings on the canvas or is it just kind of something like, oh, I'm gonna paint it?
No, yeah, no, I understand the question. So, you know, I guess it, there's certain times where I might go that direction. There's a gallery that I sometimes work with, you know, in Burbank, called the Black Sheep Gallery. And there's been times where that's kind of more of like a dark art gallery where I've kind of known I was going to be doing a show there. So I'll make some, you know, darker pieces, but I think it just comes out in my personality of just kind of like poking fun at situations or, you know, I probably at some degree have some dark background as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people resonate towards that for their own self. So I really love your art. I'm going to try and save up so I can get a piece and mad respect to all you guys.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Appreciate you. What's your name and where you calling from?
My name's Pookie from L.A.
Okay.
Pookie, we are so grateful for you calling in. And obviously with your question, you know a little bit about art. And you definitely got great taste because you want to buy some of his work. You know,
I'm
we appreciate you calling.
Yes,
oh,
an artist.
Oh,
yeah.
Great. Great.
Yeah, I'm an
what
artist
type of art do you do?
Well, funny enough, I do kind of toward the darker side. And it's kind of dark art and graffiti art combined. So that's why I wanted to know about, you know, his juxtaposition.
Definitely how he puts it together in terms of what inspires him and, you know, in terms of the elements that come together. You two are definitely kindred souls in creativity because I noticed with the questions, you know, we noticed what you were asking are definitely, like you said, the tones and the themes of how it is actually illustrated. So obviously you're pretty damn good at what you do too. You know.
Well, thank you.
So,
I think so too.
So tell us. So where can people find your work? Are you have an Instagram or a Twitter?
Me, myself.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I do. I do have an Instagram. I have an Instagram. I have two. I have one for the gallery that I'm with, and then I have one for myself. But most of my art is. You check out my gallery one. It's at Black Sheep Burbank.
Okay.
Are you checking it out now or what?
We can.
Just asking.
No,
that's cool. No. I don't want you to do that. I just wanted to, if you were asking. Well, thank you, guys. I'm sure you want to take another question, but I really appreciate your answer, Sinister. And, thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in and feel free to keep listening in. Thank you so much.
All right. Cheers, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
That's what I like right there, man. What I like what y'all do for some of y'all callers. Like, y'all get straight to the point. Because, see, one of the reasons why we don't take callers is sometimes a lot of y'all be sounding like y'all be on the phone about to snitch on somebody. Y'all be sounding like y'all in the bathroom. Y'all eating on in the middle of the phone. They all be having them snitch sounding phones. Like, come on, man. I like how she came through, got her questions. She was organized. She wasn't breathing like Jason Voorhees over the phone. She went straight to it.
Well, yeah. And at Black Sheep Gallery, because we got to check it out. Shout out to Pookie310. We see y'all in L.A. Yeah, man. And, you know, one thing about it, Jason, you know, we all got, like, a common story in all of this because there's so much we can build on what you said earlier about that being, you know, about that painting, you know, itself and the documentary that we're putting into the universe. It's going to come, but we can tell anybody, even if we weren't the first to interview you, we were one of the first to get you before everybody else did, you know, so we're proud of that. But also too, you know, more seriously, it's, the art is something that is an archive. It's something that is meant to be cherished. It is meant to appreciate it by the masses. And it's all about a passion. You know, this show right here, this is King's Baby, you know, and, you know, I joined on 4 years ago, and, you know, we know what it is to get out there in the trenches and work, you know, in terms of putting it out there and, of course, you know, uploading our shows to YouTube because we want to leave something for the masses to listen to and digest and really, really, you know, think about. And what you do with your paintings, because this is a correlation into where we are with albums right now, because we've seen over the past 10 years, we've seen a lot of rap albums go for astronomical amounts of money on eBay that are not in print anymore. Most notably, because I saw this on Amazon, and I think somebody got the idea that they were not going to sell that shit for $975. It was DJ Quick's Rosecrans EP. But you know, which as far as I know is not made physically anymore. But, you know, CDs, physical copies, are a testament. They are a reminder of something tangible that the consumer can hold. How do you feel about the market in terms of buying music? Because you were involved in music. I mean, you knew NWA. I mean, how cool is that? I mean, when you see where the market is for music now and where it was from where you started, how it was marketed, how it was produced, and how it is marketed and consumed now, Jason, what do you see the differences over the years?
I guess, like, you know, it's definitely changed, you know, the genre, you know, as a whole, and like the, you know, and all the artists out today. And then I was like, even as I was like looking at the Grammys and some stuff, and like, you know, I catch myself thinking like, man, am I like my parents now, and I don't even know all the names of, you know, who all the, like, youngsters know about these days, you know? And I always sometimes just think in my head, like, give me some, you know, some old school, right? But, you know, I still try to figure out, like, the whole making money, you know, off streaming and everything like that, and, you know, and try to understand it. And I don't know who has it better, like today's generation or like the people like our generation that was selling like CDs, you know? I mean, I guess I don't really know enough completely about the industry, you know, to make a call on it real. Yeah.
Well,
are you there?
I mean, we're here. But I think that's a situation where when we look at it, it's something that because when you talk about streaming, and shout out to Young Con the Don, you know, one of that show, King, remember that show we had with Young Con, and he broke down the numbers, the mathematics on how much artists actually get from streaming, this, that, and the other?
Okay. Is today's generation of an artist, you know, making, like, even though our, like, let's say the economy or the dollar is valued more at what it was when, you know, more artists back in the day where you would sell like units of a CD as opposed to a download or just, you know, people listening to music, you know, and, you know, iTunes paying the artist.
Well, one thing about it, Jason, is when you're dealing with the music back in the day, in terms of how, because me and King are like lifelong students of this. King actually was a journalist and actually wrote about a lot of this stuff. But when you are dealing with the music scene back in the day, you're dealing with how contracts were written, because you got to remember, hip-hop in general was something that when it really broke through in the 80s, of course, you know, rap, when you look at the nature of rap music and the genre itself, it goes back almost 50 years. You know, when you look at where it has actually become a staple in American pop culture, it's been a staple of American pop culture for almost, you know, 40 years. you know. So when you're looking at a lot of these, when you look at Def Jam, that was the first big label. They were basically, it was just you sign, you know, you record an album, and, you know, and you get money off of the albums you sell. You know, you get a percentage. Now, depending on how your contract was structured back in the day, that would dictate how much money you actually were getting. And even then, when you break down the numbers of it, a lot of artists back then were maybe getting, you know, 40, 50 cents on the dollar for whatever, you know, they, and that was per record sold, which is where a lot of these artists met. Then they made their money off of doing shows. And that was pretty much your show money was your money, you know. No, and now we have, you know, it's been streamlined now because you have more corporate entities who, because you got to remember, Jason, from when you came up and, you know, from where you were on, especially on the West Coast, you know, with hip hop culture, you know, you all, once you all really started moving with it, you all really, NWA kicked that door down for the West Coast. They weren't the first to rap, but they were the ones to really kick the door down to open it up for the West Coast. So once, you know, gangster rap really became a thing, it opened up a whole new audience. So you're fast forwarding this years later where hip hop has become a staple in commercials. You know, I mean, you got ESPN, you know, doing hip hop themed commercials and promos. And it's a worldwide market now. It's the biggest export that the United States has given to the world. So now wherever you have an export, there's money, and then people's thing is how they can make money, and then the systems they can put up to make sure they ensure they get money, which is where you have these 360 deals now that a lot of labels are offering artists where they get a piece of everything that you do, from merchandising to tour money to your album sales. Because of this, and we've had many guests on our show, Jason, that we've talked to about this in reference to the business of it and how it how the business is conducted, because a lot of times the game is not ethical. You know, we've seen situations with labels, with individuals, that there was talk about artists talking about how they were not getting their money. And this is before streaming and 360 deals became a thing. You know, so
okay.
you're looking at the modern era now where, you know,
Now,
okay, this was actually
something that they talking about doing today. They're trying to pass a law in California that's going to kill those long contracts. You know, them old slaves contract from the 80s.
Yeah,
they're about to dead that.
Okay, what's the logistics of it, King? What'd they say with it?
Well, you know, they're trying to kill off those lengthy album deals where, you know, you had to sign for those, you know, those Puff Daddy deals where you had to sign for 10 albums. Those are about to be over with.
But, you know, is that
California itself, or that's...
Yeah, I think it's California, though. They just introduced that, but I hope it goes through, man, because, man, I hate seeing a lot of artists get stuck in those type of deals.
Yeah, I was telling Jason.
Well, you know,
about,
that's
kind
of like when I think of today's, you know, generation, where at that, one thing that it, you know, is pretty dope is more people are able to get their selves out there than, you know, back in the day due to, you know, like streaming and social media. Now they can, you know, produce their own music, put out their own records with really out contracts. You know, I mean, maybe a contract is better, and, you know, in the end, but, you know, now look, you can, you know, everyone has that access, which is pretty dope too. And, you know, it just opens up the world for people that, you know, there's always going to be people that are better than other people, like the top artists, you know, the top whatever of the chart. There's going to be someone out there that doesn't have that notoriety or the like that many, you know, eyes and ears on them, but that sound better, you know? So it's cool that there's those opportunities for those people to be able to, you know, potentially get out there and make it big like that. It's pretty cool, you know? Whereas before,
is kind of hard. What are they, like, Too Short selling CDs out of the back of his car and stuff, an empty hammer, you know?
Yeah, but you know, yeah. But you know from that end of it, Jason, when you're dealing with the music industry and, like, you know, like I was saying, King has written extensively on this, you know, one of my favorite articles and my go-to is always the Prince article that he wrote. And I'm not saying this because this is my brother, because, you know, he's one of the true people in the world I love dearly. This dude, when you read that article he did, you will be blown away by the level of research he had to do for this.
That shit took months.
But he wrote about the level in terms of how Prince, you know, because one thing, rest in peace, you know, Prince Rogers Nelson, he wrote about, you know, Prince always talked about ownership of your product. You know, this is why he had that fight with Warner Brothers for so many years of owning his own name, because when he signed his contract back in the day, Warner Brothers owned his shit. You know, they basically, and Prince was fortunate from what he was able to do back in the day, because Prince was just a cosmic talent that he did everything. He was a one-man machine. He wrote, he produced, he performed, he wrote for other people.
He did everything.
You know? Yeah, so he was not bound by the levels of, you know, and all he had to do was change his name and do something else. But he had enough talent, he didn't necessarily need a label to back him, because you got to remember, for when he first started in, what, 78, you know, with his first album, For You, you know, it was 77, 78 For You with his debut album, you got to remember, this is from 77 to when we go to as early as 1984. So over that seven-year span, Prince is like that dude. You know, in 7 years, he's like a major megastar. So he made some money. You know, his contract was not necessarily, when he wrote slave on his cheek, it was not saying he was a slave, he was getting paid for pennies, because Prince was getting paid pretty good, because Warner Brothers knew what they had. It's just the fact that they owned his shit he didn't like, that where they, basically, they were basically, in, and when you have a contract like that with a label that owns, you know, the, you know, basically, I mean, I'm kind of stumbling across
they
my words, but y'all get it.
Product.
Yeah, they basically dictate the ways in which your product is distributed. I mean, in the worst case scenario, they say when you can work. You know, it's under that name. But they owned his name, but they just owned his name. They didn't own him from the context that he couldn't work under another name. And that's where he found a loophole. But he still... And you got to remember, too, he fortunately had the money that he had earned over those years where he could fight that in court. A lot of these artists, they can talk about all that boss talk about how ain't nobody going to own them and they going to do this. And then they start seeing the lawyer fees come in, and then they kind of realize, yeah, it ain't that easy. You know, but he was able to. Prince was able to win his name back. You know, he got everything back. You know, but
yeah,
one thing about it too is that
negotiations, man. Like, you gotta have, even when in every level of business, man, you gotta have top notch negotiating skills and knowing how to monitor the room and knowing who you're dealing with.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, and what you said though, Jason, with social media for what it is now, I mean, social media can be the devil, but it can also be a blessing. That's how we find rad people like you. You know, we're happy to have you on. You know, because of social media, you know, because of social media, we have interacted. The hundreds of shows that we have done, we have met so many great people. And are still going to keep doing it. And one thing about social media is it allows people and artists to not necessarily, along with modern technology in terms of video software, because back in the day to shoot a video, I mean, God, you had to have a camera crew, someone who knows how to work the everything, the boom, you know, the train, everything. Now, you know,
how funny is it now? Yeah. You can do it at home. They just, you know, they got all the stuff. You just put this on, that on, and it, the camera will follow you, edit it. You know what I mean? Like, it's so different, right?
Yeah, you can get a good mobile camera in terms of like those video grade cameras. Yeah, with those 4K cameras, you can get those for like a good video camera, professional grade, can run you around maybe $5,000 to $10,000. But it's a good investment from a perspective of you basically have something all right there that you can use, and it's not a big, it's not cumbersome. It's something that you can carry around, especially with cell phone technology. You know, even with that new Apple phone, you know, out there, you know, some of those camera features and those video features on those, I mean, are high definition. And, I mean, of course, you know, you got the video software you can put on computers, you know, and really edit all your shit. You know, back in the day, you had to have somebody to really do all of that. And pretty much if you're pretty functional with a computer, you understand, you can navigate the technology, you know, you can pretty much do it yourself. So we've come a long way in terms of that American way of the DIY, do it yourself and getting it on your own. Which goes to what I was about to say next about how for artists, because, you know, whether you are journalists like we are, whether you are a rapper, whether you are an entrepreneur like yourself, it's all about you got to know how to, like King said, network and know how to negotiate and market yourself, because you become a brand. And part of being a brand, selling your product, is the biggest thing about entrepreneurship. Is sexy, especially if if you're an artist out there and you're independent. Entrepreneurship is sexy until you realize the work it takes to actually have to grow yourself out there. Because a label, signing to a label, it gives you the resources that you need in terms of the financial and the media. You know, everything's right there because they're the ones basically footing the bill. Now, the rewards are high risk, but they are high reward, you know, but they're also high profit if you can do it yourself. And because you've seen a lot of rappers nowadays, you know, like with Currency, shout out to New Orleans, you know, with what Currency is doing, been doing it for years, putting it down. Currency has his own entertainment label, Jet Life Entertainment. You know, and Currency, basically, he does his own shit. You know, he's not signed to a label. He puts out his mixtapes independently, and he's enough of a name that dude can call up anybody and they'll work with him. You know,
hey, when you put out a mixtape like that, is he putting it on like a regular platform? Because he has like copyrighted music, right? Is he putting it on like an iTunes, or he's putting it on like a different platform?
No, he has it on iTunes.
Or he made all the beats, so it's not... Huh.
Well, one thing about it, Jason, is when you have an artist like him, and King and myself have been Currency fans for years, Currency was on Cash Money, then he was on No Limit, and then after that, he ended up going solo. And... if you go to his, if you watch his videos on on YouTube, which he has many, because he's also a car fanatic too. And when I look at the cars, I'm like, damn, how much is this guy's insurance a year? But he's got the money to do it, you know. But one thing about it is, this guy does shows. He sells them out wherever he goes. He's got probably damn near 80 mixtapes over the years that he's released, probably more than that, roughly about maybe close to maybe 10 albums. He's a name out there, you know. And he's living with us.
About the grind, brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know, and most important too, not being discouraged, because
right,
even with the changes that's going on with the world, man, cause with this whole COVID-19 thing that could shut down a whole lot of things. It's just about finding different models to pretty much navigate through the system. And did this whole crisis take effect with you?
With me? Is that a question? For COVID,
yeah,
as it affected me?
Question.
Oh, right, gotcha. No, you know, maybe certain parts, but certain parts, no. You know, so before COVID, a couple of art galleries had reached out, like two, you know, in another country, and then another one, you know, out in Chicago, and I was kind of on point to, you know, start to kind of shoot them some artwork and, you know, open up new avenues and new doors for, you know, that sort of thing. And turns out those places went out of business all because of COVID, you know.
Oh,
but
man.
Me, like, when people were, like, messaging, a lot of people just contact me because I always reply back through my Instagram. So oftentimes people will jump in there and, you know, just start to say, hey, can you do a commission piece or what about this one? And so I've actually just stayed busy through, you know, just interacting with, like, my fan base or my followers. And, you know, some of the galleries here were closed, but yet social media was still plugging away and people were still hitting me up and, you know, but so as far as, like, yeah, I did. I think COVID was okay, like, good-wise, right? But then when you look, you know, further down the road, having those galleries go out of business, and that could have been, you know, some of those were in business, like, over 20 years, I believe. So, you know, mm-hmm. I could have been – the gallery that I was referring to, it wasn't going to be, like, an overnight, like, a weekend show or a month run. It would have indefinitely remained as a staple in their gallery and been in there for, like, years to come, as long as the sales are there. But it wasn't like, oh, you're going to have a show for 2 weeks. It was like, you know, so that part of COVID affected me negatively. But as far as, like, still getting my work out and being able to make money, I just keep it pushing, you know, and have a lot of cool things coming on in the future. Pretty excited. I'm going to be doing a 63 Cadillac pretty soon. It was actually owned by a hip hop musician. It was owned by DJ Lethal, you know, the producer, you know, produced a lot of Cypress Hill, House of Pain, Limp Bizkit,
yeah,
that stuff, right? So
yeah.
A mutual friend, his partner who has a high end, he has an Allen Edge out here in Hawthorne. And so they asked me to kind of get in there and, you know, go ham on it with my artwork. So, and then it'll eventually go into maybe like Dub Magazine and then the SEMA show in Vegas. So that's pretty cool to really, you know, get to do a car. I could kind of do anything. I just do have to pay tribute to DJ Lethal along the paint job, right? And it's not
right.
A paint job in terms of like, oh, I'm getting an airbrush or I'm going to paint it with actual car. No, this thing's going to be pretty ready and prepped like a canvas, and then I'll go into it with, you know, like spray cans and brushes. So.
I mean, Jason,
yeah.
I mean, you know, your art is something that has, I mean, do you really understand the gravity, the scale of where you are at right now? Because, I mean, you're just so modest speaking on this, and we're like, dude, you're like, I mean, you're getting, you got outlets that people would die to get. And you just...
Oh, okay, yeah. No, I just equate a lot of that just to total blessings, you know, and, you know, maybe a tussle, but it's more just blessings, you know, and then just also just maybe, you know, having that outgoing personality, you know, and just, I guess, having something people appreciate or, you know, they like. Yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, but that's something that, you know, I mean, one thing about artists, because, you know, what do artists really have to understand in terms of the placements in reference to, you know, in terms of what this becomes a profession in? Because, I mean, you know, like I said, you know, you do pretty well with it, but what do artists have to understand in terms of if they're going to make this their job in terms of what goes into it, in terms of, you know, because And I know this is a crazy analogy. Have you seen the movie Lord of War with Nicolas Cage?
I have. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you know.
He went
about
to the Fed.
You know,
that's a real movie.
Yeah, it was based on Victor Boot, you know, the Russian arms dealer. But when you know, but I was going to ask you about the part with his wife, you know, because she was an aspiring art dealer, you know, while trying to sell her art, but she had so much trouble trying to move it, you know. What is it like for an artist to really come in the game? What's the market like in terms of that whole scene in terms of how it's moved, in terms of how do they get people interested, who is interested, and how do you know the people that are really going to put up, you know, real money to buy it?
Okay. Well, let me see. So I guess that was like a long-winded question. I don't even know where to start. Like, if you had to, where's the starting point on that question?
Wherever you want to start at, but primarily, like, how do artists go about trying to find their audience in terms of getting people to buy?
Especially when the market is so overcompensated.
Oh, okay. I got you. So, you know, it's a weird thing. So I think in my experience, and what I've even seen on like another artist who's kind of like doing better than I am. I mean, he's been, you know, on the scene a lot longer, but there's having that backstory, right? So people that have had, you know, certain life experiences and their art can tell a story. Aside from just like throwing up a painting and then, you know, anybody can do that, right? But what's kind of the story of this individual? And nowadays with social media, like we've been looking at everything, like, you know, his swag and this and that. And, you know, but as far as people trying to find, you know, their avenues to sell things, I don't know. I think a lot of people, the independent artists, they use these platforms like Etsy, and I have somebody that recently hit me today and said, hey, you know, can you get me into an art gallery? And, you know, other than just being like proactive and taking the initiative and calling and emailing, I would say you just have to let your art speak for you. And I think if somebody puts the work in and their art is like, you know, more along the lines of like an expert level, I think those things just kind of come naturally. You know, I don't know. They have for me, and part of it, like I said, is just having my backstory. And another artist who, you know, he has an entirely different backstory, and he's a painter, and he actually does really well because his art can, you know, even cross over into like women really liking it. So my art, it's not necessarily always sometimes think it's more like Bachelor or Man Cave or, you know, something like that. It's not really for, you know, maybe like, I don't know. But I just think like if people put in the work, you know, even if they're local area, if they just cruise into galleries and, you know, strike up conversations. I have two friends of mine that are artists, and they invited me to one of their shows this weekend in Malibu. And I was like, oh, man, that's cool. How'd you guys get into that place? And they said, oh, we just took our dog, and we were walking and went in there and started talking to the guy, you know. So it's kind of just about, you know, maybe not being an introvert and getting out there and, you know, getting in front of people and talking to people, you know. But I went to recently out here, we have what's called like a Melrose Market, flea market, and I sometimes see artists even doing that. And you know, respect to everyone's hustle, but sometimes I think as an artist, like, you know, maybe, I don't know, like, it's, you got to just put the work in, and the art will speak for itself. You know, I wouldn't advise people to go to, like, you know, flea markets and stuff, right? But, you know, if that's what helps generate, you know, their sales and gets things working for them, I guess everybody's different, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's solid advice right there, because it's also about the work ethic, man. Like, there's a lot of people that have unique work, but they don't have the drive to really put it all out there, because being that the markets are so full of everybody trying to do everything, especially since the pandemic happened, you got to go extra harder.
Right.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And one thing about it is that, you know, because, you know, we got a little bit of time left, but we got to go. But, I mean, in terms of the inspirations for what you do, man, I mean, we, you know, looking at your page, and for those that don't know, it's Sinister Monopoly on IG, you know, SinisterMonopoly. Looking at some of these, I mean, I'm seeing so many of the pop culture references. I mean, of course, you got the joint from Fight Club with Brad Pitt, with him walking, you know, of course, you got one with John Gotti. I mean, you got one with Jack Nicholson, you know, in The Shining, where he comes through the door. Look, I'm looking at the Narco one, where you got that big portrait.
Like a homemade submarine, like a Colombian submarine?
Yeah.
That shit's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that'd be, I would
be able to do those a lot faster. I have a ton of them in my head, but, you know, it takes a little while. But I have some other ones that, you know, that are in that category that kind of go along with that I'll eventually, you know, get to and be posting. And those are really cool, too. You know, like one of them could take, you know, weeks and months to do, right, because there's so much in it. I have one where the Monopoly guy is kind of in, like, one of those Miami Vice-style boats. And because it's cartoon,
right,
you know, I'll have them with, like, lots of drugs and money, like, even, like, money, like, flying in the wind, you know, above the boat kind of thing, you know? And then chasing it down is, like, Coast Guards. You know, you got Coast Guard helicopters, some Coast Guard boats, and then, like, the Miami skyline, and then, you know, the palm tree. So it's going to be kind of funny, like, when you look at those videos and they're trying to just going for it, you know, or some of those, the international, you know, when people get busted on out in international waters, I have a lot of those coming, you know. I've never really seen people that illustrate that art really so much, right? So I thought that would be kind of cool and different. Like, no one's done that.
I'm assuming pastels going to be the template for it, because it's going to be in line with that Miami type of atmosphere in terms of, like, you like the pink, like the hues. Is it going to be a lot of pinks and the light blues and the greens and all that, or are you pretty much going to go with the regular nautical colors?
Well, as far as like Coast Guards, and I was going to kind of do those somewhat like photorealism, but a little cartoony. And then, you know, the rest of it, on the Monopoly guy's boat trying to get away, I can kind of give it a little bit of a Miami vibe. So I wasn't sure in my head actually how to actually tie in, you know, the Miami skyline, unless I paint like photorealism, right? And someone can identify with a particular building. But the other day I was kind of doing it, and I kind of wanted to do something like a little more raw and abstract, and I started doing the background, like the buildings in the background, a little more almost like a Basquiat, where it was just kind of like scratchy and a little vandalism and a little graffiti. And so I just was kind of playing around with it. In the end, like, if I didn't like it, I can go back to doing something that's like a cartoon photorealism. But it kind of threw it to where it was somewhat cool. So I don't know. I'm just going to have some fun. And then I have some other ones, like another one I'll be doing is the Monopoly guy will be like in one of those boats, just like laid out almost like he's like sunbathing on just a boatload of fucking narcotics, you know, like just like anyone would take pictures they do nowadays on social media, but it's just, you know, a cartoon. of the Monopoly guy laid out like he's Escobar, you know?
Man, and you know, Jason, because, you know, I feel so ashamed of myself for not saying this sooner, you know, because we were so deep in the conversation when we were talking about, you know, when I mentioned our collectives earlier, like, you know, Jack, but thank you for reminding me when you said, you know, Basquiat, you know, Jean-Michel Basquiat, you know, from who was big in New York in the 80s, you know, was, you know, died way too soon, because I know Jay-Z owns a lot of his pictures, owns a lot of his paintings, you know, so he's another one that really spoke for that 80s era of, you know,
he's one of my favorites. He's one of my favorites. He started the same way, you know, like Banksy is just literally like tagging up the streets. You leave it?
Yeah, and I did say we would get into Banksy a little bit, because Banksy is like one of the all-time ghostface killers of anonymity in the art world. You see his work, but nobody has ever seen who he is. But I know it was a big stir in the art world where he had one of his pictures that he famously burned, and even the remnants of it were stuck.
He shredded.
Yeah, he shredded it.
He shredded.
I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that, because I'm not that fluent in art to really understand it, but I kind of get it. But from you are a professional at this. What was the conveyance of him doing that? Because he has said it was about him saying that it was, you know, this was like one of my, was it his first one or one of his major pieces that he was like, there'll never be any more after this?
I thought it was cool, and I thought, you know, everything that went along with, you know, the hype behind it was like really kind of genius as an artist to kind of get that type of, shock in the world. Right. It was like on every form of media and when that happened. So, but I don't entirely know like the true meaning. I think he was basically, something to the effect of like, he oftentimes tries to make a mockery of like art that goes for a lot of money. And tries to I think he's like more underground and stays true to the underground roots. And like, why is like this art expensive, and why is it any better than this one? Or why is it, you know what I mean? So I think he's just kind of like, through his art, he provokes so much emotion that it's also asking a question. So I think when he shredded it, it was kind of like, trying to make awareness of almost like slapping like that super fine art in the face or something. I don't entirely know the full meaning, but also by doing that, he created that shock, and it got him everywhere. Right. It was like such huge publicity. So, you know, that in itself, I think when the gavel dropped on it, I'm not in positive, but I think it was a little bit over a million at the sale. And then when the button hit and it started to shred, and it shredded half of it, I think, I don't know if they, you know, the buyer had the option of backing out, but he went ahead and purchased, you know, the art, even though it was like halfway shredded. It still had that really cool, you know, publicity and hype of being halfway shredded. Right then and there, it probably tripled in value or quadrupled in value because of the hype and the publicity. So that's even kind of just one thing that, as a person trying to get their art out there, you know, like, you know, think of ways that you can kind of like get people to pay attention to you, or publicity, or, you know, shock, and be creative. And, you know, like when you said, when people look at art, they want to feel or absorb and have an emotion to go tied into it, you know?
And I think you hit it on the head, Jason, because especially what, you know, because you are, I think you articulated that so well, because I think it was Banksy trying to basically kind of, like you said, make a mockery because of the arbitrary nature of appraisal. He was doing that as an affront to the what he feels may be the inherent ostentatiousness and outright vanity of it, in terms of how people will have, you know, in his mind, the audacity, the unmitigated gall, the colossal conceit to dictate what is worth something and what is not. And his thing, well, this is mine and this is what I think of it and this is what I'm going to do with it. You know, but like you said, the shock value, because, you know, it's funny because when you look at what is considered coveted in markets in reference to how things gain value, it's like with diamonds. There's a lot of people don't know that diamonds, there's only an allotted amount that are allowed into the world each year, because diamonds are abundant like your average granite. But if you put too much into the market, what happens? It depreciates because it's become oversaturated. So there's only so much that you can put out there that is actually, you know, to keep the monetary value. It's like in Superman, the animated series, when he fought, when Brainiac was destroying the world, then Brainiac was saying the less of something there is, the more value it becomes because of how Brainiac will go to worlds, take their knowledge, and then destroy it. Because his thing was he wanted to be the sole repository, the curator of those civilizations, holding for himself their sole legacy, their history, their culture at his disposal. When we look at fashion, you know, there's high fashion. You know, it's funny because when you look at certain brands, whether watches like Rolex or Gucci, which you're a big fan of, I looked at that art and I was like, yeah, he loves his Gucci.
Right?
You know, but the thing is when you really have a name in it, you know, it sells itself. You don't really have to do much. The merchandise sells itself once it's got that name attached to it of luxury and eliteness, because it's not something everybody can have. It's just like with, because I'm a devout Nike and Jordan kid. That's all that's in my closet. Nike, Jordan, if you're listening, I'll gladly take an endorsement from y'all. But it's like with Derek Jeter, the 11s, the suede, the blue, the dark blue suede Captain 11s that have the number 2 stitched on the back. I think those things were going for like maybe $10,000-$20,000, and they only put a limited number amount of them out.
Sneaker thing nowadays is like amazing. How like when you I'm not like big into it, but what little bit I catch here and there, I just like trip on it. You know.
Well. One thing about it is that sneaker culture has kind of always been a thing in terms of just having shoes in recent years, especially now, because when you have celebrities doing it a certain way, because now you have a lot of celebrities who are, you know, getting involved in it, you know, whether, you know, they're wearing them, like you see a lot of Hollywood celebrities, you know. You know, I think, was it Ed Helms or Bradley Cooper on one of those talk shows? I think it was. And it might have been them, it might not have been them. But I know one of them, one of those other big celebrities that had on some Jordan 1s on. You know, so the crossover appeal has become big now. I mean, you even look at it with Kanye, with his fashion line, with his shoes. And they said, you know, he's cracked $6.6 billion in terms of his assets. You know, so I mean, the market is there in terms of when people.
It also depends too on who has the brand name as well, because you see how Kanye, he caked off, and he's selling them dinosaur fossil shoes, and yeah, he caked off.
Yeah.
So it's,
but
also
it's about brand
about,
equity.
At the end of the day, who
if
the
I
brand,
can add
like,
something when. When I think of you guys, you know, mentioned, you know, the brand and stuff, and you were mentioning how, like, you know, how if any artists were listening, how to maybe give them advice to get, you know, their stuff out. One thing is some may, like painters may not know, is you want to try to do something that, you know, the repetition over and over and kind of brand yourself like me. So I do the Monopoly guy doing, you know, criminal activity, stuff like that. So eventually someone will maybe run across one and say, you know, oh, I can identify with that artist because I've seen it. No, like I didn't really, I kind of started to understand that before I left prison. Before then, I would paint an Impala. I'll paint, like, you know, the Day of the Dead. I'll paint a Monopoly. And so, you know, like, so I had the skills. I could cross paint, you know, various things. But it's like maybe no one would know who I was if I didn't continue to do something, though. And with other artists, you can find whether it's a character or, like, using the same type of colors. You know, there's an artist that paints kind of abstract landscapes that's very famous, named David Hockney. And it's just because of, you know, the landscapes, because of the color choices that he uses over and over and over, you could see right out the gate that that's one of his paintings. So I think maybe a lot of artists, maybe they don't, you know, no one's kind of, you know, put that in their head, or they haven't really thought about it, or they're just developing their style. You know, I didn't really think about it until somebody kind of explained it to me, you know, and so it all kind of made sense. So, you know, maybe for those out there trying to do their thing, you know, find something to where they, if you just do the repetition and get enough of them out there, you know, where people see them, then they can identify with them, and then they kind of grow, you know, their reputation, you know.
Definitely. Now, you already got the heat with the paintings. Is there any possibility that you might try to do an extension brand and going into clothing with it, or designing clothes?
You know, there's periodically, like in the past when I've done, before COVID, like a physical art show where, you know, a Saturday night opening, people might come. I've had like shirts made that kind of go with, you know, the theme of the show, or sometimes we'll just do giveaways and stuff like that. But I've never, like, gone out of my way to try to, like, you know, start an actual brand with it. So there has been times where, like, I've, even for the holidays, I'll buy maybe some hoodies and have maybe just a selective amount made, probably even under 100, and then leave them with, you know, some of the galleries that carry my stuff. And then that's really about it. So I've had a lot of people, like, saying, hey, you know, where can we get hoodies? And so through my website, I'm just kind of, sometimes I'm bad about really, like, having things put on there all the time, because, you know, I don't do that myself. I have someone that does that, right? And so me just even, like, emailing and uploading, and sometimes it just gets a bit much to, like, I have so many things that I could constantly, you know, be putting up there, right? Like, all sorts of, you know, hoodies. I have so many originals I've made, right, where I can, you know, keep pressing that out. So I think through my followers, they seem like something they would kind of be into. So I think in the future, even recently, a gallery that carries my work, he told me, you know, hey, like, you know, let me know what I think, you know, I'd like to give you a whole merch section. And he wants me to just manufacture a bunch of that stuff, you know, hats and hoodies and stuff like that. But, you know, I think just it's about me putting in the work and grinding, and then in time all those things will happen. I think more than anything, I just want, you know, make art that people, you know, dig it, and then, you know, build a fan base, like, even, you know, like musicians and performers. Eventually, the fan base comes the sales of the merch, you know, or the clothing brand. But, you know, maybe potentially even, like, having clothing would even be more lucrative than my artwork. I don't know. But for now, I just, since I've been out, just working on being, like, you know, an original painter, not really so much doing so much clothing yet, you know. What do you guys think? Well, are you down for some Sinister Monopoly clothing?
Dude, we're here for all of it. We just, okay. I mean, because where fashion is right now, I think it will really hit. I think, you're going to be, they talk about Kanye being a billionaire. You might end up taking that spot with that, because, you know, the artistic scope of what you have, only thing that would probably be a bitch about it is, you know, the trademarks in terms of the the illustrations you might use, and you'd have to clear a lot
sure.
of trademarking with people. But if you can get a lot of those people on board with it in terms of showing, because, you know, you can just show them what you've done in terms of you being on an independent scale of making, you know, a living for yourself, and how with their blessing and their resources added to what your innate genius is, how all y'all can put it together. So then that would just have to go into which company would you want to, is this something that you would think about doing independently, or would this be something that you might want to link up with a brand to, you know, help push it?
So, you know, I have seen, you know, other artists that do like paintings like I do, and they work with clothing brands, and I thought that's kind of cool. But to some degree, I probably, you know, until those like sort of deals represent themselves, like that, you know, I just do some independently. So I guess mm-hmm. What I would probably end up doing is, I don't know, I have had one clothing brand hit me up, and people have asked me for licensing, but I just never really got so into it. But I guess, you know, like I said, my whole intention now is just to try to get people to, you know, enjoy what I'm doing and then follow it and then kind of dive into that. But I think for starters, I'll probably just independently do it.
Well, one thing about it, King and myself, we're part of the money team. We always, we shout out to Mayweather and Al Heyman. We say that tongue in cheek, but we're serious because we support what they do with their movement. So we're always going to tell anybody, and the spirit of the money team, the essence of it is that it's about doing what you do for you. A lot of people get mad at Mayweather, but Floyd Mayweather, he deals his own business. He, you know, he has his consultants with his boxing promotion, but when you deal with Mayweather for a fight, you're dealing directly with him and his people. There's no middleman, you know. You're dealing with directly with him, you know, and that's how it should be. So whatever your next move is, Jason, in terms of your clothing, just make sure you're maintaining your brand equity in terms of you're owning your intellectual property. No matter how much money they try to offer you, make sure you have complete creative control of what you are doing, where they do not own what you do. You decide what is going to go and what is not going to go. But
yeah,
you know,
we'll just tell them, right? We'll get it the ski mask way.
Man, look, if it come to that too, we'll be like, look, we'll be suited up with the ski mask, with the, one of those Benellis and those HKs, and be like, look, this is what it is. Take it or leave it.
Well,
you know,
no, I meant just like fashion wise. I was just saying, I was being like sarcastic, just saying. But
man.
Yeah,
so, I get you.
Yeah. Hey, so I heard some music rolling. Are you guys winding down? Like, how long do you guys normally roll right now?
Well, we roll for 2 hours. We always have the music coming in. No, it's not like the Oscars where we play the song to kick our guests off. No, sometimes we keep the music rolling just as a background. We do cut the music off occasionally when we have good dialogue like we've had, but we are nearing the end, you know, because it's coming up on 11. We don't want Blog Talk kicking us off, although sometimes we can cheat a little bit and get extra time. But, Jason, this was informative. This was educational. This was thoroughly enjoying. We appreciate
likewise, you.
We love what you do for the culture. We love you. Keep doing what you're doing. You have our support. Anything you want to promote on our show, you're more than welcome to let King and myself know. And God bless, Godspeed, keep doing what you're doing, man. And when you do get that big Netflix documentary done on you, we want to be
let's put it out in the universe.
Yeah, we got to say, look.
And then it's like, you know, life, it's like just next level, right? I imagine, you know, what if, like today, what if somebody could tell, like, somebody like who's, you know, incarcerated now, like an El Chapo, right, to make paintings and send them to the outside world, to our galleries? How much
Dude,
do you think
you
those
know,
paintings are going to go for? Right?
Man,
and so
dude ain't got no
what about
already.
It, what about Boston George? What if he's a painter? You know what I mean? And so I'm just saying, like, if I can get in there and people can kind of eventually get to see everything on, a larger platform, then they would
mm-hmm.
realize, like, oh, man, like, fuck, these paintings, you know, like, at that point, they're going to, you know, quadruple.
Yeah, man. Hey, you
people
might even be able to
understand, you know,
George Young. Reach out to him.
When they talk about, you know, stripes, I put in the stripes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man, but I saw, because we're going to try to stretch it a little bit, you know, but, I mean, I saw you did a little thing for Supreme in your one of your pictures, you know, in your painting. So, I mean, you and Supreme might be able to do a collab. You and Calls might be able to do a collab. I mean, you never know. Just make sure.
Oh, man, that sounds beautiful.
Yeah, just make sure that they keep their business right on their side, you know, because you're the one bringing the talent in, and they got the name. So what do you have?
Exactly.
You
so what I always tell them is that they should be so lucky.
Right.
Well, I'm just joking, right? You know what I mean? But, no, those opportunities, you know, would be really cool to kind of, you know, and that's where you look at fashion nowadays, all of those high-end brands. To some extent, they use actual painter artists like myself, and you know their references, or even they just, you know, like you said, Cause and all those guys, they have those huge contracts with that type of companies.
But I tell you one thing, you have an untapped market still. I mean, you're doing well, but you got a market that will. I mean, I won't even say well, you're doing great, but you got an untapped market of a lot of people that still have not heard of you. And that's why we wanted
exactly.
to do this show to get you out there, because we recognize this is part of what we do on this show. You know, we want to give a shine, a light to everybody, no matter who they are, no matter what walk of life they come from. We want to be part of that trail that they go on, that we recognize and respect it and want to give them a chance to tell their story. We're about to close shop, Jason.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. You're welcome back anytime.
I appreciate you guys anytime, yeah.
Yes, and keep doing it, man. And Pookie,
likewise. Hey, thank you guys.
And Pookie, definitely. And Pookie, if you're listening, baby girl, thank you for calling in earlier, and you keep doing what you're doing. And we support you at Off the Cuff, too.
All right. Good looking out, man. Thank you guys so much. Everybody have a blessed night. I appreciate everybody who tuned in and for thanking you guys for having me on, man. God bless.
Definitely, man. Be blessed and thank you. And we out.
All right, bro. We'll talk to you guys. See ya.
Yes, sir.